Welcome to another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show, where we explore gay history one bar at a time. I'm your host, Art Smith, and our guest today is award-winning author, storyteller, and essayist, Jobert Abueva. Well, welcome to the show, Jobert.
Why, thank you, Art. Glad to be here.
I am always excited to have new guests with new stories to tell. And I know from our conversations prior to this interview that you have traveled to quite a number of gay bars in quite a number of cities around the world.
That I have. Go ahead.
Unfortunately, we don't have an endless amount of time for each segment. So on this one, we both agreed that what you're going to talk about is your bar experiences in New York City in the early 90s. Is that when you moved to New York or?
Yeah, I actually moved. I lived in New York even as a kid, traveled the world, grew up here and there in Asia. But I did end up in New York in the late 80s. I had a job in Cleveland. I started working at Macy's in the buying office. And then I eventually got into business school in Manhattan. So that's the time period we're talking about.
Okay, so that would be right around 1990 when we're going to start talking about. What's the first gay bar you remember that was particularly important to you in New York that made some kind of an impact?
Wow. It would have to be when I was in New York in the 80s, Uncle Charlie's. There was an Uncle Charlie's in the village, and then there was actually an Uncle Charlie's in Midtown, I recall. In fact, I met my first long-term relationship at, I'll never forget, it was like the day after New Year's in 1986 at Uncle Charlie's Midtown. And so I remember that. I don't think either one is around anymore. But then fast forward, I came back to New York in the late 80s after college and my first job out of Cleveland, when I ended up at Macy's, and started going to bars after work and meeting friends after classes in business school. Primarily around the east side, Midtown, east side of Manhattan, because there are several bars there that are not that far from each other. You can kind of hop from one to the other. And then being a marketer, studying marketing, I figured out, oh my goodness, I could bring all the new international students and those who are not familiar with Manhattan to this little section of the island and do what I call a marketing segmentation tour, since we are studying about marketing segmentation in class, to talk about how different gay bars cater to different clients and audiences. So that was the framework for my so-called marketing segmentation gay bar tour of the Midtown East Side of Manhattan.
So, considering the fact that you have a marketing background and that you did these tours, what segment of the population, of the gay population, would you say that Uncle Charlie's was designed to attract?
Oh, so Uncle Charlie's was probably like the catch-all, right? It's like the entry point. Whether you're new to the city or you're just coming out in midlife or whatever stage you are in, that's kind of like that would be like the gathering place to orient yourself with New York City. And it's an easy, casual place to go to. So I would say that was probably the one where everyone gathered. And then you started to learn about other bars in the area. And then you would start to gravitate to the segments that were most interesting to you. For example, the next one I started going to was the Townhouse. And a lot of folks know about the Townhouse in Midtown, which is still there to this day. And I would say that catered to a clientele that, well, eventually it became kind of like a commercial kind of establishment. But before then, it was a lot of suit and tie folks who wanted to have that cocktail after work. I remember meeting a number of UN diplomats that were gay, either were out or not. So it was very cosmopolitan. It was international, and everyone station, and there was the lovely piano playing in the back room, and everyone was yucking it up that way.
Now, keeping in mind that this was the early 90s, that is a phenomenon that had occurred in numerous cities. A lot of cities that had a number of gay bars had a bar that was kind of what you would call an upscale, almost businessman's club. I remember from my days in Atlanta, there was the Far Library. I think in New York there was also one called the Barbizon Library. And then at one point in Boston, you had the Napoleon Club, which was kind of an upscale, slightly snooty piano bar. The Townhouse in New York has endured. As you said, it's still around. And it's, from what I've seen, I've never been there personally, but from what I've seen, it's kind of got an imposing presence on the street. There's a rather prominent staircase that leads up to a
That's right.
very nice door. It's not a shady little space that you go down an alley and crawl in the back. It's very kind of grand and elegant and in your face.
You're absolutely right, Art. And there was someone there at the door that kind of played, security, dress code check, if you will, before you entered. And you would go in. It was relatively subdued, dark, subdued colors, drapes. It was almost like a funeral parlor at times because of the lighting and all the drapes. And then there was the upstairs, and then there was the downstairs lounge where gentlemen would sit and then just start eyeing each other and trying to build up conversation. The other bar that comes to mind is Rounds, which was 2 blocks away from the townhouse. And Rounds in the day was known as the what I call the supply and demand bar, where when you walked in, you could almost clearly tell who was providing, who was the supply, and who was the demand. And where the two met, the so-called equilibrium point in economics, was really exciting to watch. To see how people started to engage with each other and eventually negotiate what would happen for the rest of the evening. And we're talking monetary negotiations. So that was also interesting. And it did attract a high-end crowd, if you will.
At least on the demand side.
At least on the demand side. True, true. And then now you remind me, right next door, a couple of doors from Rounds on the same block, was a place called the Regent Bar, I believe. It was really small. You went down a few steps. I remember a lot of mirrors, whites. There was, I believe, a piano player too, but it was a really cozy space. But so from a segmentation standpoint, I call this the geriatric crowd. Because it did cater to gentlemen of a certain age. I was in my 20s, and when I brought my friends in, we were arrogant 20 somethings, and we'd look around and said, "Oh my gosh, everyone is kind of slouching on the lounge, the along the couches and ready to keel over." But they were there with their martinis, and so that was another bar. Obviously a different one. And then now as I talk about it, I'm also reminded of another bar in the area, the Star Sapphire Lounge, which was on First Avenue. And that was all about Asians and their admirers. So you'd end up there and a lot of Asian cliques, friends would gather, do a lot of chatting. And then gentlemen who were not Asians, were there with purpose, a certain purpose in mind. And that too was fascinating to watch the engagement between the two sets of customers.
So far, the bars that you've described all seem to have some sort of a transactional nature involved in them.
What bar doesn't have a transactional nature?
I guess
But I
that is
hear
very
you.
true, especially in that era. Now, did you find that not being a Caucasian white male in New York, that there was a different way that you were perceived as you went to some of these bars compared to the way, say, I would be perceived in the same bar?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say undoubtedly yes. I think, you know, this is the case in many places where people, you know, because it's about, you know, you seeing the physical first and foremost, that you make assumptions about someone. You know, perhaps there were times when people assumed that I did not speak English as well. And then when I started opening my mouth, they were like, whoa, where did you learn to speak English? So there was a bit of that. Also, just the sense of being a little different. And, you know, it's part of the game, if you will. And I, for one, you know, I'm a bit extroverted and I'm happy to strike up conversation. So, in a way, the onus was on me to kind of break out of whatever perception others had of me to just, you know, be out there. And that made all the difference because I did meet some wonderful people and had wonderful conversations, and in fact, even had acquaintances and one or two friends because of that strategy, if you will.
And you mentioned a point that I have discussed a couple of times with other guests on the show about the kind of melting pot nature of some of these bars. And I don't necessarily mean racially, but more socioeconomically. Unlike a lot of mainstream, you know, hetero bars, which tend to have a clientele that gravitates toward a single socioeconomic kind of level, the gay bars, you would have somebody in there who is maybe a high school dropout, and as you mentioned earlier, a UN delegate or a, you know, member of Congress or a CEO of a company, because the opportunities for gay people to interact and socialize were more limited. So they were kind of almost thrown into the same kind of melting pot. So you got an opportunity as a graduate student in marketing in New York to interact with people on a number of different levels that were not exactly the people that you would meet, say, at the college cafeteria.
That is so true. And then you throw in all the tourists, right? It that's what made it so exciting and fun. And I'm glad I was around in that particular period, at that particular location, to experience that, because you and I don't need to tell you how different it is today with the availability of social media, and perhaps the younger generation doesn't feel it needs to go to a gay bar, that anywhere is a place to interact. So I, in a way, there's so much nostalgia that goes with that period, and I'm sure folks of our cohort, if you will, bemoan that because it was a wonderful time, right? You went in and you just never knew. It was like whatever surprise there was, good, bad, or ugly, right?
Absolutely. And it was a very interesting time. My first gay bar experience was in the late 70s. And
Right.
so by the end of the 80s, I was well entrenched in the concept of going to gay bars. In fact, I had relocated in the early 80s from Nashville, Tennessee to Atlanta, Georgia, because of the vibrancy of the gay bar community there. When I went to visit, I couldn't believe how many places there were and how many people there were that were openly gay. And the same thing is true in New York City. There are so many opportunities in the 80s and 90s to just drop into bars, and particularly in certain neighborhoods. I mean, I know, for instance, the Village has a long, long, long history of being kind of very openly gay. So in your marketing tours of these different types of bars, what other kinds of bars did you stumble across? Were there any really like wild and crazy underground clubs or flagrant dance clubs or anything that was in sharp contrast to some of these others.
In that same area, I remember there was one called the Web. So that was an interesting one where you had to go down a set of stairs, and then there was this bar that overlooked even further down into a dance floor. That was very popular. It was also in the East 50s. And for some reason, it kind of became another Star Sapphire, where who knew there were so many gays, many so many gay Asians, if you will, in New York City, and they gravitated there. We gravitated there, and a lot of other folks gravitated there. You didn't necessarily have to be just an admirer of Asians to be there, but it was a very popular spot because the music was good. And there was something about that balcony effect where you could have a drink, look down, and people could look up, and there were lounge chairs downstairs. And so it had a great vibe to it, almost a bit Saturday night feverish, if you will. So that was good. And then, of course, it's a whole other story to talk about everything that was going on in the village, right? Off Christopher Street, because that was a whole other scene unto itself.
Yeah, and New York has had so many colorful bars over the years with so many different kind of stories going on there. I've cataloged quite a few from New York City dating back into the late 1800s. And some of them have been revived at different times. Some of them just kind of dwindled away. But there's always been an interesting story to tell about the gay bar scene in New York City, in Manhattan particularly. Now, when you were there, I'm trying to think, was the limelight in full swing yet?
I believe it was. I don't have my dates exact on Limelight. So I had been to the Limelight a couple of times. And then it became, was did the Saint happen before the Limelight or the other way around? I don't remember anymore.
I think the Saint was first.
The Saint was first. Okay, so I'd been to the Saint and then I had gone to Limelight. Yes. And you know, being growing up a good Catholic boy, it was a you know titillating and a bit whoa, what am I doing here to party in a former church? So, but that was fun.
Yeah, and the Limelight was not exclusively a gay bar, but they certainly had a strong gay presence, and they went out of their way on certain nights to really embrace the most diverse community they possibly could. It was an interesting time in New York's nightlife scene. And I have interviewed Ernie Glam, who you may remember from going to the Limelight if you were there on a big gay club kid night. He dressed up as a 6-foot-tall yellow chicken and was Michael Ehrlich's sidekick.
Oh,
So
funny.
I interviewed him about a year ago, and the response to that interview is incredible. He's still in New York and he still parties there.
Still kicking. That's great. So I do want to mention, I know we're talking Manhattan, but I lived on Staten Island, but I went into Manhattan and there was a bar on Staten Island called Sandcastle. And what was so unusual about it is that it was someone's basement. So it was in the middle of a residential neighborhood on by South Beach. And how odd was it that you went into this very quiet street, but then people were in the basement. It was almost like a speakeasy, and there was a dance floor and a real bar.
Wow. And what kind of clientele did they attract?
Local, the locals, the Staten Island locals.
So I'm guessing they didn't really like promote or advertise the bar much, or they were kind of underground in that respect. It was word of mouth and
Very much so. And I brought my friends from business school over to Staten Island once to go to this bar. And the funny story is, one of my classmates was told that, oh, he was so young to be in that bar that the guy bought him milk instead of a drink.
all right.
Odd memory.
Now, my project has always had a certain degree of a marketing aspect to it. The actual project started with a conversation with a bar owner from Atlanta and digitally reconstructing their logo because so many of the logos of those bars from back in the day just practically vanished. They were either never documented, or they were on some scrappy piece of paper somewhere from a newsprint ad. And so I undertook, as part of my project, digitally reconstructing the logos of whatever bars I could find from old photographs and magazine ads and flyers and all kinds of things. And Web 40 actually, I'm calling it Web 40 because in my mind's eye, the sign on it said Web, but there was a number 40 behind it, which I assume was a street address. So I knew about that bar already. Now, were there any of these bars, and you mentioned a couple that were kind of Asian oriented, were there any bars in New York City at that time that you felt particularly excluded from or not welcome in because of the fact that you're not, a white Caucasian male?
That's a good question too. I'm trying to recall. Not necessarily. Like I would even stray into the village, and I remember going to the Monster, right, and other places where I did not feel excluded. Again, maybe I wasn't necessarily everyone's cup of tea, so I just put myself out there. And at times, I would have great conversations and make a nice connection. There was one bar that I had gone to that I it's not that I didn't feel uncomfortable. It's just that it was catering to a different crowd. It was mostly a Latino bar and Latinos admirers. I think it was called La Escuelita. Does that ring a
Yes,
bell?
it does.
By Port Authority, right? And I think they even had go-go boys. So anyway, that was very much, I recall, very predominantly Latino. Just as I'm sure there are African American catering bars, Hispanic, Asian, and whatnot, right?
Yeah, there was one for every flavor, literally. And of course, back in those days in the 80s and 90s, there were seemed to be a lot more segregation in the bars. I'm not saying they didn't allow people of different varieties to show up in the bar, but they were geared toward different, very specific genres of clientele. And today, the trend seems to be more toward the queer bar. So bars today, it's kind of frowned upon in a lot of places. If you are excluding females or excluding trans or excluding drag queens or excluding any particular group, it's kind of looked down upon and considered to be kind of, a throwback to the old days. And
That's right.
so I'm seeing a lot more integration now than you did back then. So it's a
Inclusivity is important, and I'm glad that we have made strides in that direction. But people weren't thinking about that in the day, and you just had a lot of establishments for different subsets of folks, right?
Absolutely. So these people that you brought on this marketing tour, obviously, they were not all, or probably even mostly, gay people. They were just students in the class. Did they?
They were pretty much the gay students.
Oh, okay.
There
So
maybe there may have been it, there may have been one or two who were real sports, and they weren't from Manhattan, and they wanted to be familiar with different parts of the city. So there were straight people who I would take on these tours as well, and they were thrilled because it was a very different aspect. That they are not used to, but because they were friends or we were friendly, they trusted me, and we had we had a great time over beers.
prior to the time that you were doing this at the late 70s and throughout the 80s, with the advent of the disco scene, you started to see more integration of people outside the gay, what we now call LGBTQ, but what we then called the gay community. You started to see more outsiders showing up in the bars because the quality of music was better, the
Exactly.
facilities were better. I mean, there are some amazing bar facilities, not only in New York, but around the country. And one that immediately comes to mind, I'm not sure if you've had an experience there, but the Palladium was just an amazing space. I don't think I've ever been in a bar where the main section of the bar had 100-foot high ceilings. I just don't
That's
think
right. You're right. It had that, didn't it have a huge screen as well?
it
I
did.
don't know. Yeah.
Behind the screen, when they didn't have the screen down, there was a huge Keith Haring painting there. And then they
Okay.
also had another room, I think, that had a Basquiat painting that, they embracing the local up
Sure.
and coming arts community who now have become, amazingly famous. But back
Yep.
then were kind of local street artists and less, much less well known than they are today.
That's right. And I don't know, did you get to watch the Andy Hall
I did.
diaries?
I did.
Yeah.
And I am so thrilled that there are so many stories out there now, movies, books, blogs, podcasts that are embracing gay history. In fact, there was recently, I just noticed that I discovered it today. There's, I think it's a magazine in called New York Family. And they just did. For LGBT History Month, which is this month, October, they did an article about seven LGBT history blog or history podcasts for LGBT History Month. And, we never would have dreamed of that 30 years ago, that a magazine with the name Family in its title would be posting anything about gay history, let alone inviting people to follow these different podcasts. So, and there are movies out there, some of them good, some of them not particularly favorable to our community, like the whole Dahmer project that
Oh my
keeps popping
goodness.
up.
Can't get past episode two.
But in any event, it's being talked about. And I feel, privileged to have started this project several years ago and watch, my Facebook group grow. I have over 5,000 members in the Facebook group that talk about gay bar history every day. Watch, the number of podcasts I've done. This interview is number 106. So I have done over 100 interviews with people talking about their memories of gay bars around the country and occasionally around the world. And there's a genuine interest out there. Two friends of mine just released a book, which I would love to see somebody do one for New York, but they released a book about Chicago's gay history. And it's called Last Call Chicago. And it features 1,001 LGBT spots in Chicago going back as far as 1921. So
Wow.
that's amazing. And
That is amazing.
New York, I'm sure, can, double or triple that if they could actually record them all. So it's great to learn about these places and have people who were there being able to confirm them and verify them and say, yes, I was there, and yes, it was cool, and it was definitely gay. And I met my first husband, lover, boyfriend, trick, sex partner at this bar. It's just amazing to me.
So it's wonderful, Art, because in a way you're doing a fantastic service. I mean, those of us who have these fond memories of the era, it's good to preserve those. And if anything, for posterity, for history, even decades and centuries from now, it was a special period. And there's so many establishments that were special. So I really applaud you for this project of yours. And I know about that book that just got launched about the Chicago bars. I know Suki. So yeah, that's really wonderful.
Yeah, and I interviewed Ian Hensel,
Yes.
about a month or so ago, and he was also talking about gay bars in New York City in a similar time frame to where you are. I think he started a little earlier, but he was talking about a number of gay bars, and if I remember correctly, he was more focused on, he did mention Rounds. I'm sure he mentioned that, but he also focused on a number of bars that were on the the seedier side of town, down by Tompkins Park and Alphabet
Oh my
City
goodness.
and
Sure.
some of those. And there are so many that could be talked about. Now, one of the first bar that you mentioned, well, second bar that you mentioned, was Townhouse.
Yes.
And Townhouse, just as an aside, also has a connection with a string of gay murders by a serial killer.
I read the book.
I did. I've read so many books. There's a whole shelf full of books behind me that are all books about gay bar history and all kinds of stuff. But there was a connection there as well. Was that going on while you were there in the early 90s
That's a
or?
good question. I believe it was, and then I think it was also after I had left New York to go
Did
to London for work.
that have any impact? Like, did you talk about it, feel the pressure at the bar or in that neighborhood at all,
No, you
or?
know what? I must have been oblivious to it. And the book I just read, Last Call, right?
Yeah.
That's the recounting. I mean, for folks who may not be familiar, that what you and I are talking about were those series of murders that actually happened to patrons of the townhouse.
Right.
They met this gentleman, and then, you know, it's funny because I live now in New Hope, Pennsylvania, and even the local bar is mentioned, the Raven,
Yeah.
in the day. And you know, sadly, some of the remains were found on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. I mean, it was a little gruesome and nutty, but you know, danger lurks, and unfortunately, it hit that establishment. But I was oblivious.
Yeah, I had a feeling that was the case. I know a number of instances where there have been, violent activity that was somehow or other connected to a bar or a gay district, a gayborhood. And people very often either were oblivious to it or it was like water off a duck's back. They heard about it, but it didn't apply to them. Oh, yeah, well, he was kind of promiscuous. He would go home with anybody. Of course, he was going to eventually run into trouble, kind of thing. They didn't take it to heart that they were at risk as well. But, and if I'm not mistaken, there was also some violent activity, and I can't remember exactly what associated with Escalita. Either I can't remember if it was the owner and his boyfriend, or there was some kind of a scenario where there was, I think, a murder that was connected to Escalita. I'll have to look into that again.
Yeah, I don't remember that offhand, but I, you know, you do remind me, even in that time period when I was there, you know, you did have, there were two things you worried about. One was your safety, because you did hear about gay bashing incidents, if
Right.
not in New York, around the country. And then, of course, you know, AIDS continued to loom, right? So that also influenced the way, you know, you maintained yourself throughout the evening. I didn't want to get too drunk or whatever, right? So those still were always in the background, even as one enjoyed a drink and looking to meet folks.
Now, out of your few years in New York City, what was the one bar that you really miss and wish you could go back to?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. So, because I went to business school on the Upper West Side, up at Columbia, I remember a bar. I think it was in the 80s, the Waterworks. Does that sound familiar to you?
Does. It does.
Yeah. So, I like going there because, you know, you could go with friends. It wasn't that, it was just a couple of subway stops, right? Down there. And it had a funky scene to it. I remember there was like a lot of, I don't know if it was like plastic netting or what, gave the feel that you were in a army boot camp or something. You know, there were some dark corners, whatnot, but it was accessible, great location. And I liked the crowd there. I met some really nice people who became friends. So I guess I'm tying it to the fond memories I had there.
Of course. Of course. And I'm sure it was quite a different clientele than the suit and tie crowd at the townhouse. I mean, that would
Jeans,
probably.
jeans and t-shirt. They could be suits and tie during the day, but a lawyer or
Right.
a Wall Street guy, but very jeans and t-shirt, that I remember.
Yeah, we've all known people like that. They're kind of chameleons. You almost don't recognize them at the club at night because they're so diametrically opposed to their presentation during business hours.
That's right. That's right. They could really be more themselves and let loose and have fun.
Now, in New York City, there was, a wide variety of neighborhoods where you could go out. As you've mentioned, there were bars in Midtown, there were bars in the Village, there were bars all over the place. But lately, we've been seeing a little bit of a movement. It seems like most of the newer bars that are opening up in New York City are opening up in Hell's Kitchen.
Yeah.
That seems to be the new hotspot for the gay community there.
It really is. And I remember the migration. Yeah. Obviously around Christopher Street, right? And then it moved to Chelsea. And I remember catching that wave with places like Splash. I lived around the corner from there for a while. And then now Hell's Kitchen. And I go into Manhattan every now and then to see a Broadway show, see friends, have dinner. I've only been out a few times, but they're all there, and they all, again, great location, and there aren't as many bars as before, so it's still quite lively. And but that's where it's at. Where next, right? Hudson
Now,
Yards.
you mentioned that now you live in New Hope.
Yes, in
I
Bucks
grew
County.
up, I grew up in a town called Woodbridge, New Jersey, which you may be familiar with. It's where the Turnpike and the Parkway cross. And and we used to make semi-regular trips to New Hope when I was a kid. My parents liked going on little day trips to different places. And one of the places we went probably once every few months was New Hope because it was an interesting kind of artist community. It was a very artistic, kind of laid back, cool, little cleaner version of maybe Greenwich Village in its heyday. And there were quite a number of bars there too. I've cataloged quite a few. There's I remember the Cartwheel was one of them. The Raven, of course, is still there, right?
No, it's
Oh.
become a parking lot.
Oh, that's right. I do remember reading that. Yeah, so the Raven was there for a good while as well.
It was.
And there were a number of others. And it's for people who are not familiar with that section of the tri-state area, it's pretty accessible to central and southern Jersey, Trenton, Philadelphia, any of those kind of areas. New Hope is kind of right in there. It's not way out, like it's, I don't know, it's probably about 3 or 4 decades away from Pittsburgh. it's the opposite end of the spectrum. But
I love living in New Hope. I caught the Cartwheel back when I moved out here in 2000 before it burned down. I'm not I live quite close to where the Cartwheel used to be. That was a fantastic spot for dancing. And at one point, it even claimed to be like the biggest gay spot between New York City and Philadelphia. The Raven was here for a long time. It was before my time, but there was a very popular place called the Prelude.
yes.
And then at one point, the hotel up the street was the Nevermore. But also, because it was such a welcoming community, you're right, there's a lot of arts, a lot of theater with the Bucks County Playhouse and whatnot. It really attracted this eclectic crowd. And it still does to this day. It's just that now there is no gay establishment, although I understand next month we're going to have a reopening of a place called the Cub Room that was across from the Ravens. So that's something to look forward to. And then there's a gentleman who started a gay men's club of New Hope, David Martin, and he started sponsoring events up the street at the hotel. So there are a few things, and A number of places have tea dances on Sunday. The Havanas does, and the deck, which is connected to the playhouse. So a lot of activity is coming back to the area.
Yeah, and you're still close enough to New York, as you mentioned, that you can go into the city for, a Broadway show and a dinner and whatever, and experience the excitement that is New York City without actually having to live in the madness that it can be every day.
That's right. And I also am lucky because on the other side of it is Philadelphia, which is a little closer than New York, and then you got the gayborhood. So, and I'm not as familiar with Philadelphia. I've been there a few times, so that's an opportunity for me to explore.
Absolutely. Well, I loved hearing about these bars that you used to go to in New York City, and it's really kind of interesting to kind of put into perspective, because I think you're the first person who's ever told me that they actually made a presentation about gay bars in a business marketing sense. Everybody else talks about them as, oh, that's where all the hot guys hung out, or that's where all the shirtless hustlers were all the time. And he took it from a completely different a different angle. So that's kind of interesting. Now that you've moved on and you're living in New Hope, you've been writing and telling stories and doing things of that nature. What projects have you done recently that would be of particular interest to the LGBT community?
Oh, thank you for asking, Art. So I'm really happy to share that my boyhood memoir, which is titled Boy Wander, is actually going to be published in 2023. And it's going to be published by Ian Hensel and Suki Senkrog, Rattling Yarn, Good Yarn Press. And I am over the moon. It's a project I've been working on for over 20 years, on and off. I was able to finish it up when COVID hit, and now it's gonna see the light of day. So I'm really thrilled about that. And I'm writing a lot of short stories, op-ed pieces. If I may plug, jobertabueva.net.
Absolutely.
And you can learn more about my different projects. I'm going to be in Queer Anthology in the spring,
Oh, wow.
which is a European-based literary journal. And I this year won a special prize from Lambda Literary, the J. Michael Samuel Prize for Emerging Writers Over 50. So, it's been a good year for my writing. I still have my day job as a global marketer, but at night I'm a writer. I thrive in it. I'm happy to be one, and hope to keep at it. But I'm really excited about the book launch that's happening, and I think we are now scheduled for spring of 2023.
Excellent. I love Ian and the Rattling Good Yarns Press family. I have interviewed several of the authors from there. I've interviewed Rick Carlin. I've actually
Sure.
interviewed him twice, once over a year ago, and then more recently about his new book, Last Call Chicago. I interviewed Suki Delacroix. I interviewed Ian. I just released yesterday, I think it was, an interview with Daniel Jaffe.
All right, I love
So,
Daniel. Yeah.
and that's the general feedback that the Post has been getting. Some of the people I interviewed that were not authors or not related to Rattling Good Yarns, but were connected with Boston's gay history from back in the day. That's what he talks about mostly in his interviews, Boston's gay bar history that he remembers. And several of the other people I'd interviewed and several of the people that are members of my group have made great comments about how much they enjoyed his interview and how entertaining it was. And they were so glad to hear other stories of bars in Boston that they didn't talk about. It's a really rewarding project when you get that kind of feedback from people, and you hear these other people who are not just innocent bystanders, but were actually participants in our gay bar history, who are enthusiastic about the stories that the other people have to tell. Because it's easy to be enthusiastic about your own story. I
Right.
mean, Most people like hearing the sound of their own voice at some point, but to actually be entertained by somebody else's memories is another thing entirely. And I'm really glad that you hooked up with them for this book, because from what I can tell, they are a driving force in LGBT literature these days. I just got a message from Ian earlier today that in their launch party in Chicago, they completely sold out of the books, and that they're
That he
waiting
told
for a
me, yeah.
reorder so that they can get get more out there. And Amazon apparently jacked the price up because it was doing so well on Amazon. So,
There you go.
but that's good news for all of us, because that tells us there's an interest in gay history.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I'm really thrilled to be partnering with them. They're great guys. I love their vision in gay literature, LGBTQ literature. And so I really lucked out. Yeah.
Yeah, for me, it will be forever gay. I think after having been indoctrinated for 30 years and using the term gay to refer to the queer community, I don't know that I can ever really get used to saying LGBTQ plus all the time.
Right,
But
I
it
hear you.
means the same thing to me. And this project, I have talked about women's bars, about flagrantly queer bars, about all kinds of spaces. I'm not limiting to, the strictest definition of gay being, gay homosexual male. But yeah, it's great to see all this interest in in this field and the whole concept of LGBT history. In fact, I was up last week at Atlanta Pride,
Oh, you were.
which I like to go to once in a while because it was my first big pride, and back in the 80s, and it is also just an amazing experience of like 2.5 days of over a quarter million gays taking over a city park and embracing their diversity all weekend long. But I was also invited, and I will be doing in a few days, an interview with the local public radio station about gay bar history. And to me, that's another notch in the tool belt. That's another, hey, another outlet that is looking to talk about gay history. And the more I see of that, the more of a smile it puts on my face, and the happier it makes me know that this history is actually finally getting the recognition that it deserves.
That is wonderful. And I can't wait to check out some of your past episodes. So,
Well, I welcome you to do that. At the end of this segment, I will put up some links to your website and other information so people that are interested in learning more about you and your books and what you're doing can follow you there. And I invite everybody to go to the Gabe Archives Facebook group, and you can share your own memories there. Talk about the bars that you remember. Ask questions. I've had people, authors even, who have been working on a piece about gay bar history or gay restaurants in New York or whatever, and post something up there asking for the members to post their memories to enhance the writing of that particular journalist or author. So it's a very interactive community, and I love that.
I'm gonna check it out right now.
So, in the course of your going to these gay bars and looking at them from a marketing perspective, what impact do you think these bars had on the communities that they were in? Were they a positive factor in helping the community, revitalize, or did they have a negative impact on the communities in general?
Oh my. Well, from my perspective, in their heyday, it was positive because, you talked about how you met your first lover or boyfriend. I met significant folks at the bar. It was just such a wonderful place to be. You could let loose, you felt safe, right? Because you knew. People knew who you were. You did not have to explain yourself.
Right.
And that there was a lot to be said for that. That was empowering. So I think at a personal level, the bars were really positive. I still think it's positive to have them today. Maybe I'm just a little grayer, and my tolerance for alcohol has gone down a bit. So I'm good for one round, a nice stiff round, a martini or a Manhattan. But then I also I'm fine with going back to bed early. I think I'm glad we had the bars of the eras I think about when I was younger. I'm glad we still have them today, and some of them are coming back to my neighborhood. And I really hope they're here to stay, regardless of, you know, where we go technologically, culturally, socially. It's important to have gathering places like that. You just never know who's gonna show up, right?
I agree 100%. And I think we must have been doing something right, because over the decades, all of our neighborhoods are being overtaken by the corporate world and mainstream America. After we have beautified them and gentrified them, then they want to try and run us out. So we must have had some foresight that they didn't have, because they weren't there in the nitty-gritty days and the, you know. So apparently there's some advantage to having a gay history in the neighborhood. For marketing that space as a, you know, a better place to live down the road. So we're doing something
Right.
right.
You know, they say the gays come in and then they gentrify it, or they really, you know, take it up a notch and then the prices go.
Well, Jobert, thank you so much for taking the time to talk about some of your gay bar memories and about the projects you're working on.
Thank you so much, Art. It was a lot of fun, and keep at it. And thanks again, and thanks to everyone who listened.
That concludes another episode of the Gay Bar Archive Show. For more information about this episode, or to find more episodes, visit gaybararchives.com.